You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Hello, kitties, and welcome to my world. I would come over and say hello to you, but it's just as easy for you to come to me. Yes, yes, come in. You've come to the right place. This is where you'll learn everything there is to know about your furry feline friends. I'm talking about cats. Yes, I know, we are positively perfect pets. What do you mean I have attitude? Why, of course I do. I'm a cat. It's called catitude. As I was saying, this show is all about cats. Cats and, cats. So let me introduce you to my accomplice, assistant and host of Catitude, Tom Dock. Okay, Tom, tell them how wonderful we cats are. It's okay. You have my permission.
Well, hello again and welcome to Pet Life Radio, and this is the Catitude Channel on Pet Life Radio. My name is Tom Dock, and I am your host for all things feline, and I'm very excited to be back here doing some research for the show today. I realize that we've gotten through a majority of the CFA recognized breeds, if not all of them, on the cats, and a lot of the email that I get at tom@petliferadio.com has been focused on, why don't you talk about the domestic kitties? And domestic kitties are so wonderful, domestic short hairs and long hairs and medium hairs, and why don't you talk more about them? Well, we'll certainly do that for a little bit today. I also want to spend a little bit of time today talking and defining what is a feral cat. Now, I think this is hugely important because there are many communities all across the United States and in other parts of the world where feral cats are very controversial, and the controversy is not that their cats are there, but the controversy, of course, is what do you do with all of these cats? Are they a health risk to people? Are they a health risk to our pets? And what's the best option? Should we just simply euthanize the majority of them, or are there other options like trap, neuter, and release? And we'll talk about how all of those programs work and some of the controversies that surround programs like trap, neuter, and release. I also, towards the end of the half hour today, I want to talk a little bit about the different flu strains that are out there, because we did get some news recently about a cat in Iowa who was diagnosed with the H1N1 virus. At least he tested positive for the virus, and we'll talk about how that's different in just a few minutes at the end of the half hour. But there's a lot of confusion out there, both with the avian flus and dog flus, and over in Europe, and of course down in Australia, they call the feline upper respiratory complexes, they call those the cat flu. So what is your cat susceptible to, and what can you do to make sure that your cat doesn't get one of these types of flus? So that's kind of the outline of what we're going to be looking at today. I, of course, want to take a quick break to thank our sponsors for all that they do for us. And as is my tradition, I thought I'd give you guys a little bit of a trivia question here. And this may be a little difficult to answer, but it'll kind of set the tone for our show. So, how many feral cats are in the United States? How many cats running wild are out there in the United States? I will give you the answer when we come back right after these messages.
Ooh, do I hear a can being opened? I believe I smell tuna. Catitude will return after these messages. That should give me enough time to investigate what's going on in the kitchen. Don't have a hissy fit. We'll be right back.
I love cleaning the litter box, said no one ever. Luckily, there's World's Best Cat Litter, the litter that promises less mess with less litter. Only World's Best Cat Litter uses the concentrated power of corn to quickly trap odors in tight clumps. And quick clumping means you never have to chisel or scrape the box. Less cleanup with less wasted litter? That's a litter bit amazing. Save $2 on World's Best Cat Litter. Visit www.saveonworldsbest.com.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
How dare they open a can of tuna and make a sandwich out of it? I can see why some of my celebrity pals prefer lasagna. Well, anyway, I did manage to grab myself the canary while I was in there. Quiet, bird. We're going to hear the rest of my show, Catitude. If you behave, I may not eat you. until later. Okay, Tom, you may continue.
And we are back on the Catitude Channel here at Pet Life Radio, and I am your host, Tom. I want to talk a little bit about just our normal domestic cats today. Not going to go into purebreds, talk about any specific breeds. We're just going to talk about the Mogies, as they're known over across the Atlantic, and has even been picked up here in the States. A term for a domestic cat, a non-purebred, is known as a Mogie. And certainly that is the vast majority of the cats that we see here in the United States are domestic cats, whether they're short-haired, long-haired, or medium-haired. No pedigree. Most people are, you know, find these cats when they're out at a farm somewhere. You know, there's certainly people that let their cats breed in the cities too, which is something, of course, we want to talk about pet overpopulation at some time in the future and how you should always spay and neuter your cats. But you know, domestic cats have been with us for a very long time. We did a show a little while ago about how these cats started hanging out around human settlements about 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. And so these guys have been around for just a very long time. And certainly with their profusion of different colors and their antics, I think they've just really warmed their way into our hearts. I get a lot of email from people who say, you know, there's so many domestic cats in shelters. Why are you talking so much about these specific breeds? Well, when we started this show, we thought we needed some sort of format to get going on. And of course, the format was going to be, let's talk about a certain breed, the characteristics of that breed, the physical characteristics of this breed, and of course, the health issues that this breed might have, and then talk a little bit about cat problems towards the end of the half hour each time. And we've gone through about all 41 of the CFA registered breeds, and there's, I know, dozens of other cat breeds out there that some of you may be asking, you know, when is he going to talk about this one? And we'll get to all of them eventually. But I think we just want to do a little bit of a focus on talking about how, you know, a cat is really a cat. And although you might have a calmer Persian versus a excitable Siamese or the always getting in trouble Abyssinians or Asa cats, the domestic cats can really bring a nice blend of all of these together. In fact, since I stopped breeding Persians and since I stopped breeding Siamese, I don't think I've had a purebred cat in those years. And that's been, gosh, we're pushing 15 years or so now. Everybody has been just a domestic cat. And some of them have been picked because maybe they looked a little bit more like a Siamese, like my Fozzie cat looked like a Siamese or a Ragdoll mix. My Aphrodite was a Lynx Point Siamese, or at least looked like a Lynx Point Siamese. But I think an important thing to point out here is no matter what the animals look like, they really aren't that breed of cat unless they've got three or more generations of being bred pure in a pedigree. So in other words, if you've got a Siamese-looking cat, it's great that it's a Siamese-looking cat, but that doesn't mean that it's a Siamese. Because again, as we've talked, these genes for whether it's long-haired Persians or the Siamese points are recessive genes. They're mutations that have cropped up during the course of the evolution of the cat, and a lot of cats will carry these genes. You know, my Lynx Point that I called a Siamese, my Lynx Point Siamese Aphrodite, when she gave birth to her litter of six kittens, there was not a Siamese kitten among them. And I've still got her son Vulcan here, and he's just that big, long-haired, orange and white cat that you may have seen pictures of before. So I think the important thing with this is whether you get a purebred cat or whether you get a domestic cat, we all know that felines, they touch our hearts. We love their antics. We love their expressions. We love to talk with them, sleep with them, all of these things. And I think that's what we really need to celebrate here. I want to kind of switch gears just a little bit because there's a controversial topic that cat owners should know about and should be start taking a position on. And I'm not going to tell you what position you should take because honestly, I don't know what my position is right now either. And that, of course, is what do we do with all of the feral cats? Now, before the break, I mentioned having a trivia question about how many feral cats are here in the United States. There's no way to know, but estimates are pointing at there are at least as many feral cats in the United States as there are owned cats. In other words, cats that go home each night or stay indoors all the time. So we're talking about another 80 million cats in the population that are living on the fringes of our society, in doorways and alleyways and sewer drains and things like that. I think it's also very important that we make a definition between feral cats and stray cats. Now, feral cats have had no socialization and no human contact whatsoever. They are born from cats that are out in the wild or running around, whether it was a stray cat or an own cat before. These kittens have not grown up around people, therefore they have no socialization to people. They don't want any contact with people, and they will run from humans at the first and earliest opportunity that they have. Now, stray cats, on the other hand, stray cats are usually animals that have either, one, run away from home or gotten lost from their home, or two, been abandoned by their owners. And you can tell the difference because stray cats will readily approach people wanting to be petted. They'll be purring. And even in these colonies, in these feral cat colonies, you'll have a mixture of feral and stray cats. And then, of course, you've got to factor in that there are some cats who are owned who simply roam the neighborhood as well and interact with these colonies too. So all of these, feral, stray, and owned cats, are all part of Felis catus. Okay, that was the genus and the species for our domestic cats. And as I mentioned earlier, they have been part of our society for 8,000 to 10,000 years, living on the fringes of our society. And one of the arguments that people who want us to leave feral cats alone use is, gosh, you know, they've been around for this long. They've lived at the edge of our society, you know, subsisting on, you know, rodents and lizards and birds and things like that, and insects for so long now. We shouldn't try to change that. We should treat them just like they were another wild animal, whether, you know, treat them like a raccoon almost, that we shouldn't go out of our way to do something different about them. Now, we also know that cats are very well equipped to survive, for the most part, without human interaction. First, they've got a very high reproductive rate, and of course that's leading towards the 80 million cats, feral cats that are out there, but they're also proficient hunters and they're very independent. Whereas a lot of dogs, you don't see a lot of feral dogs. You get dogs that are lost every once in a while, but they just don't do as well. They want to thrive on that human companionship, and so you don't see the large populations of feral dogs. Of course, they're a lot easier to catch too and remove from the environment. But most dogs that you see are actually stray and will eventually warm up to you and even come into your home or be able to be captured fairly easily. And that's not the case with these cats. They are very wary of people and a lot of times will run away at the first sight of a person. So what's so controversial about this? You know, why don't we just leave them alone? Well, there is, according to some people, an impact on wildlife. So we know that cats are hunters. We know that they're going to eat insects and lizards and rodents and birds and things like that. Are they truly impacting our wildlife? Again, with any controversy, you're going to have two sides. Alley Cat Allies, which is a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to stopping the killing of feral cats, says that feral cats actually have a minimal impact on wildlife, and that actually human intervention or human expansion and the loss of habitat is what's really hurting all of these birds. Now, on the other side of the coin, groups like the American Bird Conservancy actually say that these 80 million feral cats are probably responsible for 500 million bird deaths every year. Now, how did they come up with that number? This is very interesting, actually. There was a study done in Wisconsin, and they estimated that there were 1.4 million feral cats in the state of Wisconsin. By trapping some of these cats, and after they euthanized some of them, they looked at stomach contents, and they determined that an individual cat usually would kill somewhere between 6 and 8 birds on an annual basis. So by extrapolation, 80 million cats, each killing 6 to 8 birds on an annual basis, that's where you get close to your 500 million birds every year. And again, Alley Cat Allies says, well, it's not really the cat's fault. It's humans' fault for destroying the habitat. The birds could always go to a different habitat. There's another website called TNRRealityCheck.com, and they are actually saying, why are you dismissing this secondary cause? Yes, we all agree that human expansion and development has caused the loss of habitat, but, you know, why dismiss the fact that cats are killing birds as well? And I thought this was very interesting. They said, you know, it may be that disease A is the number one killer of women, but you don't forget about breast cancer, or you don't forget about heart disease or anything like that. You know, you just can't just shove those to the side. So that's one of the controversies. The other wildlife controversy that we're seeing right now is that there was a study done back in 2003 by the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, and they found that a whopping 76% of sea otters on the California coast were infected with a parasite called toxoplasmosis. And we'll talk a little bit more about toxo here in just a second, but that a large percentage of these marine mammals were getting infected with this parasite, and actually some of them were actually dying from it. And it was due to the runoff, the freshwater runoff going into the sea from all the storm drains and everything that's just carrying these parasite eggs down into the ocean. It's a very interesting impact that our cats may be having. Now, how about transmitting any kind of diseases? Now, this is another controversy. Do feral cats transmit disease? Well, let's look at rabies, first of all. Rabies is a zoonotic disease that can be transmitted to people from our animals. We have laws in place where we need to vaccinate all of our dogs. Most states also say vaccinate cats and ferrets against rabies. And we have greatly diminished the human rabies here in the United States since earlier in the 20th century. Still, in 2008, the CDC's rabies surveillance showed that more than 400 cats, I believe that's the number, showed up positive for rabies during that year. Actually, I'm looking for the number right now. It's 294 cats as compared to 75 dogs. So that's four times the number of cats positive for rabies as dogs. There were only 75 dogs in the whole of the United States during 2008. So they are more likely to carry. They're also, the feral cats aren't as likely to get vaccinated because who's out there vaccinating them? So that's a problem too. Is that going to become a public health hazard at some point in the future? We also briefly mentioned toxoplasmosis. Let me tell you a little bit about toxo, because everybody worries about toxoplasmosis. You know, pregnant women aren't supposed to clean the litter boxes and things like that. Toxoplasmosis is a parasite. Cats will get this parasite by eating rodents and birds, and the cat is the definitive host. This is the host where the parasite reproduces. So the cat gets the parasite, it reproduces in the cat, and then the cat sheds the eggs of the parasite for about a 2 to 3 week period of time after infection. But guess what? The cat never sheds that parasite egg again. Very rarely are you ever going to see a cat who's been infected with toxoplasmosis still shedding years down the line. It doesn't happen. The other thing about toxoplasmosis is that the eggs that are shed, they're actually oocytes that are shed, will take anywhere from 1 to 5 days in the environment to become infective. So if you're a good cat owner and you're cleaning that litter box on a daily basis, there's no chance of you getting toxoplasmosis. Now, a large percentage, well, not a large percentage, I would say about 22% of people in the United States over the age of 12 have been exposed to toxoplasmosis at some point in their lives. Most of us never realize it, no big deal, we go on with our life. But for people who are immunocompromised, it can cause some main problems. And of course, pregnant women, it can cause abortion of the fetus and also some brain damage of the newborn baby. So it is a concern, and you do want to be careful. You know, maybe have husband clean the litter box, but what about these feral cats in the environment? Can they be spreading toxo? Well, certainly, and we know that from what's happening with these studies and concerns about sea otters. But is that enough to say we need to get rid of all of these feral cats that are out there? And then finally, as far as concerns that we have, there's also parasites like hookworms and roundworms. cats that are running around in the wild are going to use sandboxes and other areas to defecate, and that can spread hookworms and roundworms, which of course are potential problems for us and our children. So what are we going to do about these feral cats? Now, Alley Cat Allies, and I talked with their founder, Becky Robinson, a few weeks ago. You know, her whole purpose was that she views feral cats much the same way as a wild animal. And she thinks that the fact that most communities simply trap and then euthanize these cats is absolutely wrong. And a very sad statistic, which is true, is that 70% of cats who go into shelters end up being euthanized or end up being killed. They do make a difference between euthanasia and killed. You know, euthanasia basically saying they're giving you an easy death so that you don't suffer. Well, you know, there's a debate about whether these feral cats are actually suffering. What I can tell you from working in a shelter situation is many of these feral cats are certainly not adoptable. They've got no socialization to humans whatsoever, and they don't do well in the setting. They will eat up resources. You've got people trying to take care of them, trying to calm them down. They're taking care of their food, litter boxes, and things like that. So it's understandable that a shelter on a limited budget is not going to want to actively pursue trying to rehabilitate, basically, these feral cats, if that's a possibility at all. So Becky's whole issue is that we need to start looking at a solution, and the solution is trap, neuter, and return, or TNR. Now, I want to tell you a little bit more about that and go into a little bit more detail, but we do need to take a break and hear from our sponsors. So you hang on right there, and I'll be back in just a minute.
Ooh, do I hear a can being opened? I believe I smell tuna. Catitude will return after these messages. That should give me enough time to investigate what's going on in the kitchen. Don't have a hissy fit. We'll be right back.
Molly, here's your dinner. Zeus, that's not your food.
Don't let that happen to your precious cat. Elevate your cat's eating experience with the Cat Tree Tray. The Cat Tree Tray keeps your cat's food off the floor and conveniently located on the cat tree. It's the perfect way to eat. It's a beautiful wrought iron tray that easily attaches to your cat tree and keeps dogs and other critters out of your cat's dish. A must for multi-pet households. There's a 6-inch tray for large bowls and a 4-inch tray for smaller bowls. Purchase your Cat Tree Tray today. Go right now to cattreetray.com. That's cattreetray.com. cattreetray.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
How dare they open a can of tuna and make a sandwich out of it? I can see why some of my celebrity pals prefer lasagna. Well, anyway, I did manage to grab myself the canary while I was in there. Quiet, bird. We're going to hear the rest of my show, Catitude. If you behave, I may not eat you. Until later. Okay, Tom, you may continue.
And we're back for the end of our show here today. We're talking about feral cats and just got onto the topic of trap, neuter, and return. And this is different. Some of you may know TNR as trap, neuter, and release. Well, what they have found over several years of study is that these feral cat colonies are actually pretty territorial. The cat likes to go back to that area that he knows. And by just simply releasing it somewhere where he doesn't know, he's going to find his way back eventually. So they've changed the nomenclature to trap, neuter, and return. And what basically is going to happen is you're going to set out some of these traps and you're where there's a colony. The cat goes in to get some food, gets trapped in a live, humane trap, and then taken to a participating veterinary clinic where they are anesthetized, they are neutered, and generally then vaccinated for rabies and distemper. Now, some people might be asking, well, why don't we vaccinate them for other diseases like feline leukemia and feline AIDS? And that's a very good question and brings up yet another controversy about feral cats. Generally, the retroviruses, feline leukemia and feline AIDS, generally feral cat programs don't test for these retroviruses. And that's simply because it is a cost prohibitive type of venture. And in order to get good results, in order to get accurate results, you need to test multiple times. In other words, if you bring one cat in on day one and the cat is spayed and then vaccinated, you need to retrap that cat about 28 days later to retest it in order to make sure that that first test was truly negative or truly positive, because there are false negatives and false positives for a variety of different reasons that we won't go into here. But so that's going to be cost prohibitive. And then, of course, as you may have already figured, trying to trap the same cat multiple times, of course, is more of an issue as well. Now, I also mentioned that they will give them a rabies vaccine. I know that studies in dogs have shown that a single rabies vaccine has proven at least 3 years duration of immunity. So that's a good thing, that probably we're not going to get rabies from our feral cats, but it still is a public health concern. And you've got to have a large percentage of the colony vaccinated if you're going to develop what we talk about of herd immunity. In other words, if you've got a population of 100 animals, you need to have at least 50 to 60 of those animals vaccinated for rabies so that if one animal does get rabies, it doesn't spread like wildfire throughout the rest of the colony. And of course, with the interactions that these cats are going to have with wildlife, with raccoons and other animals that may come up and try to take the food that the caretakers are leaving, there is a good possibility that they can get that. So they definitely are going to want to vaccinate, and then they return the cat to the same area where the cat was trapped so that he's back in his home environment. There's a lot of controversy about TNR, and I would invite you to go to both alleycatallies.org and tnrrealitycheck.com. Both of these sites have some very interesting scientific research showing that TNR works versus TNR doesn't work. And if you want this person's opinion, don't know if you want it or not, but you're going to get it because you're listening to the show here. I simply think that, again, like so many things in our world, this is only going to work with the right people handling it. There are too many cases where you've just got a supposed, you know, feral cat enthusiast who is doing nothing more than feeding the cats. And when they're feeding the cats, that's going to encourage emigration into the area because it's an easy food source. You don't have enough people who are working hard on sterilizing these cats. We need to get somewhere between 70 and 80% of the cats sterilized in order to start seeing a difference in the population that's out there. And an interesting fact that just came out not too long ago, more than 90% of owned cats are neutered. So they are spayed or neutered, but less than 10% of feral cats are spayed or neutered. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. All right, well, we're going to shift gears here just a little bit, because I do want to talk about this case that came out of Iowa last week about the cat that had H1N1. Story goes like this, that there are three people in the household. One of the people evidently worked for the Iowa State University School of Veterinary Medicine. And two of the three people came down with flu-like symptoms. And about a week later, they noticed that their cat wasn't doing well, that he didn't want to eat as much, he wasn't grooming as much. And this was a 13-year-old cat, by the way. So certainly older, but not geriatric, not ancient by any stretch of the imagination. So 13-year-old cat. And he wasn't doing well. In fact, what they really said was the biggest thing that made them think something was wrong was that he was sitting on all fours, hunched up like he was having problems breathing. And if, you know, cat lovers, you know that cats mainly lounge around, that you don't normally see them sitting on all fours like that, kind of puffed up. And so they took the cat in, and after a battery of tests and x-rays, one of the veterinarians had decided that, you know, maybe we better test for H1N1 because these other folks in the family had already had it. And they did. The Department of Public Health in Iowa, along with the USDA and, of course, the veterinary school, ran a battery of tests and did confirm that the cat had H1N1. Now, the cat has since recovered and is doing well. But it begs the question, are our pets at risk for a certain type of flus that we get? The general answer to that is absolutely not. Most flu viruses are very species specific. They don't like to cross lines. You may have heard about this dog flu that's going around, the canine influenza. That is actually a variant of a horse flu that took about 40 years to actually mutate and start being able to infect dogs. And so we don't anticipate, at least veterinarians don't anticipate, that we're going to start seeing a big rash of H1N1 in our pets. Now, if you have a ferret, it's a little bit different situation because ferrets seem to be a little more susceptible to the types of viruses that do infect us. We have very similar receptors on some of our respiratory cells, and so they can seem to get it. And I think there's been a total of 5 cases now in the last several weeks where ferrets have come down with H1N1. But can they transmit it back to us? There's been no documentation of that yet. And there's been no documentation that they pass the virus to each other. So in other words, no pet-to-pet transmission either. Now, I think this cat was probably a little bit of a fluke. And I actually saw a veterinarian who wrote in on a message board the other day, said something along the lines of, you know, just because you found the virus in the nasal secretions of this cat doesn't necessarily mean the cat had the disease. That could have had some respiratory problems for other reasons. I don't know that I necessarily agree with that, but certainly it's odd that this virus would jump over to cats, and I think it's just a very extreme case, and we probably won't see any more like that. Cats can't get the dog flu either. We've not seen any transmission of the H3N8 dog flu into cats. The only thing that we have seen is the H5N1, which is the avian flu, the bird flu that had everybody scared for several years and still is a pretty major concern. That has been documented to be transmitted to cats, especially if they're eating wild birds and fowl. Now, luckily, we've not seen H5N1 here in the United States or in North America at all. It's stayed over in Asia and to a certain extent Africa and Europe. And those are where the documented cases of the cat transmission has come from. So basically, to break it down, H1N1 in our cats, very, very unlikely to happen. One thing you want to do if you've got flu-like symptoms, even though they are some of the best medicine out there, don't snuggle with your cat. You may want to go ahead and make sure you wash your hands real regularly. And until you're better, you might not want to sleep with your cat. The dog flu. Cats don't get dog flu. Now, again, we're never going to say never because viruses are tricky little things that can mutate pretty rapidly. But what we understand now is that cats don't get dog flu. Cats can get avian flu from eating birds that have been infected with avian flu. Not a problem here in the United States, but just something that you should be aware of for the future. And then finally, what is a cat flu? Well, the cat flu is something that folks in Asia and Europe refer to the upper respiratory complex of diseases that we see with our cats. In other words, the herpes viruses, the Khaleesi viruses, things like that. And it's not a true flu virus, but they do call it the cat flu because it mimics flu-like symptoms. Well, I think we're about out of time here, and I do appreciate once again the fact that you guys have joined us. When you get a chance, make sure you go to PetLifeRadio.com and check out my friend Dr. Bernadine Cruz and Dr. Diane Levitan as they talk about all sorts of interesting medical cases on the Pet Doctor Show here at Pet Life Radio. I was just looking through some of the headlines they have here. One episode that I really think you should take a listen to is Pause to Save Pets. This is, of course, a very important issue for pets and how they're treated during disaster type of situations. Hurricane Katrina taught us a lot, and one of the big things it taught us was that people want to stay with their pets. So how do we take care of pets during these kind of disasters? And you'll not only hear Dr. Cruz, but you'll hear Dr. Hal Little of Mariel Animal Health and how Mariel has committed to giving money to these organizations to make sure that our pets are taken care of in any future disaster. So make sure you check that out. And also, at any time, if you have a question, please email me at tom@petliferadio.com. That's tom@petliferadio.com. And so once again, it's time to say goodbye, and I'll see you guys back here on the Catitude Channel real soon.
Want to know what cats like to eat for breakfast? Mice Krispies, of course. Learn everything there is to know about cats on Catitude with your host, Tom Doc. Each week, we'll spotlight a cool cat breed, give up-to-date advice on cat health, and check out spiffy new cat products. So curl up on the couch every week for a perfectly enjoyable time on Catitude. Every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.